to 10%. We actually have better odds of making it now.
A smile tugged at the corners of her mouth. That's an optimistic way of looking at it. Edward poured batter over the brown sausages and slid the casserole dish into the oven.
There, that's done. In a half hour, you'll have a taste of Britain's finest comfort food.
Her smile faltered. Having his full attention cast on her was like wandering into a spotlight on an empty stage.
Now, I did mention the champers chilling in the fridge, yes?
He asked. Before she could reply, he took out the bottle.
Let's toast our new arranged marriage.
Coming off an intoxicated year, she still desired the glorious numbness that came with being under the influence. She hadn't been addicted to the substances as much as their oblivion. I'd love to, she said. While he retrieved crystal flutes and opened the bottle, she struggled with a thorny irritation that he was so well-oriented in her kitchen. Reminded herself he wasn't an invader in her home, but a resident. I hope I made him sign a prenup. Her neck heated at the unkind thought, though it was practical, since Edward would be out of her life by 2015. Unless I can change my future. Regardless, she made a mental note to search her office for pertinent legal documents. The cork's pop brought her back to the moment, a sound that always struck her as more violent than celebratory. A glass filled with fizzy amber liquid appeared before her.
To arranged marriages,
Edward said. They clinked glasses and Una chugged hers, keen to alleviate her muddled thoughts.
Need a top up already, eh?
He grinned and refilled her glass with a flourish. A doughy, meaty, hearty odor permeated the room. That smells incredible, Una said. How'd you get into cooking?
My late mum was terrible in the kitchen, bless her heart. So I began making our suppers as soon as I was allowed to use the stove.
He leaned his elbows on the kitchen island.
I can't blame her. She spent days on her feet as a hairdresser and came home knackered. So there were a lot of bland soups and stews set to die a long death in the slow cooker.
And your father? What did he do?
He worked on cars. Retired now.
Did he cook?
No. His palate is non-existent. Probably wouldn't have noticed if his veg had motor oil on it instead of gravy. Which reminds me.
Edward went to the fridge and removed a Tupperware container of gravy, which he heated up. The second glass of champagne also went down quickly, but she turned down a third. She already had a light buzz and a headache.
Happy birthday, by the way,
he said, while sifting through the silverware drawer.
I should have said it sooner, but with everything else going on, it slipped right out of my mind. Last week you said you wanted to keep things low-key, so I didn't make posh reservations anywhere. I hope that's all right.
No, low-key sounds good. Una had more than enough excitement. When the meal was ready, Edward took out a single glass plate, which he set before her. Aren't you having any?
I like to prepare food more than eat it.
He scooped a golden brown brick onto her plate and poured gravy over it.
I promise it tastes better than it looks.
Una took in a messy forkful. Wow. I can see why this is my favorite dish. The sweetness of the eggy batter paired with the tangy pork sausage and rich gravy made for a bite she wanted to both savor and devour. It's a shame British food gets such a bad rap.
That's something I hope to change.
He passed her a napkin. Do you cook for a living? Have your own restaurant?
Yes, and soon.
Soon?
I'm currently a chef at a Carroll Gardens bistro, but I'll be opening my own place in Gowanus next month.
That's exciting. She helped herself to more gravy.
For both of us.
The fork paused a few inches short of her mouth. How's that?
We're partners in the restaurant.
He scratched at his collarbone.
Though granted, most of the financial contribution was yours.
She put her fork down. Are you telling me I bought a restaurant?
I suppose that's the simplest way to put it, yes.
Una's eyebrows shot up. She assessed her plate with a new eye. What do I know about running a restaurant? Una asked. She and Edward were on their way to Clary's Pub, due to open at the end of February. As the taxi crossed the short bridge over the dingy green waters of the Gowanus Canal, they left behind the tidy, tree-lined streets of Park Slope for a neighborhood filled with mismatched buildings, dilapidated warehouses, and auto repair shops.
You're more of a backer, but I know this industry, and we've hired people to handle the design, construction, accounting, PR, you name it. We have a small army of skilled people.
Gamble on the unknown, her letter had said. Would their marriage survive even if their restaurant didn't? They approached a converted red brick carriage house. A shingle hung over the wide black doors. Clary's Pub, carved onto it in old English script. Beside the door was a sign that read, "Coming soon."
Isn't this a great property?
He asked as they got out of the car.
We got a good deal on it, too.
I can see why, she said. The desolate street contained warehouses, a sign-making store, and farther down the block, yet another auto repair shop. A dirty plastic bag blew in the breeze like a tumbleweed. There doesn't seem to be much of anything around here.
Maybe not yet, but the area is undergoing scads of development. Gowanus will become a trendy neighborhood before you know it.
He unlocked the front door. And if it doesn't? Because it wouldn't, not to that extent, at least by 2015. Edward turned around, mouth pursed.
Are you getting deja vu having this conversation? Because I am.
Ignoring her blank expression, he continued.
If it doesn't, though I believe it will, this can be a destination restaurant. Look at Peter Luger. People have been coming to East Williamsburg for ages just for that steakhouse.
Actually, Williamsburg would have been a better choice. That neighborhood's gentrification was already in progress. The struggling artists and musicians who enjoyed its inexpensive housing wouldn't be able to afford living there in a decade's time.
Well, we didn't get a space in Williamsburg now, did we?
His voice was light, but his jaw twitched.
None of the places we saw there were quite right. Besides, Gornus is right between Park Slope and Carroll Gardens, two neighborhoods with gobs of money. We're hardly asking customers to trek out to Staten Island. Now, can I get on with the tour of the restaurant, or would you like to stand out in the cold and bicker some more?
It was like a teacher admonishing a grade schooler. As the one funding the restaurant, Una had a right to voice her opinion. But she didn't want to kick off her marriage with a fight. So she put a hand on her husband's arm and adopted a conciliatory tone. I don't mean to argue. There's so much I need to learn all over again. Sometimes I get hung up on details.
Well, don't.
A quick squeeze of her fingers.
That's my job.
He opened the door and waved her in. The raw space had a bar running along one side and an exposed brick wall on the other. Bare light bulbs hung from electric cords, and exposed beams revealed a high ceiling threaded with ductwork like geometric aluminum snakes. The floor was covered in power tools and drop cloths. No furniture? Una sidestepped errant extension cords.
It's coming in a few weeks. There's still some electrical work that needs doing, and the ceiling has to be finished, so that all needs to get squared away first. Come see the kitchen.
She followed him to a room with lots of brushed steel, pots and pans suspended from ceiling racks, a wall lined with fryers, flat grills, ranges, and other equipment gleaming under the harsh white light. Edward pointed things out with the enthusiasm of a little boy showing off his Christmas presents.
And this tilting skillet is top of the line.
While he talked, her mind drifted. What were her friends from 1991 doing now? Recovering from some terribly fabulous party? Had any of them settled down? Had Sin followed her advice and become wealthy? And what about Kenzie? He'd be in college now. How long before she saw him again? She meandered around the kitchen, running a hand over metal counters, smooth and cool to the touch. Everything new. Yet another blank slate. Edward came over and draped a casual arm around her shoulder. The weight of it should have been disconcerting, but it felt natural. Nice.
You're making a childhood dream of mine come true.
He gave her a quick kiss on the cheek.
I've said it countless times, and I'll continue to say it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Her face burned with the lingering warmth of Edward's kiss. How could she not be moved by his excitement and gratitude? Tell me about the menu.
Oh, yes.
His eyes flashed, and his fingers splayed out, trying to create an image for her.
The concept is British meets classic French. Chateaubriand with béarnaise sauce and Yorkshire pudding. Shepherd's pie with dauphinois potatoes instead of mash. Bouillabaisse with a side of bubble and squeak. That sort of thing.
Una wasn't familiar with half the dishes he listed, and didn't know whether customers would be either, but let herself be swept up in his enthusiasm as he led her back to the dining area and continued to share his plans for Clary's Pub.
We're thinking of having a curtain separating the bar from the dining area. We can accommodate about 100, depending on how you do the layout.
He took her around the room in a circle as he talked.
Let me show you something else.
Down a short corridor at the back of the dining room, a door opened out onto a waterfront patio.
When it gets warmer, we'll serve food out here. Let the guests take in the view.
And the smell. Her eyes watered at the potent stench. Sewage, rotten eggs, garbage left out too long. How much worse would it get in warmer months? The view wasn't much better. The polluted canal was dark and grimy, speckled with patches of oil and litter. Beyond the water was an elevated subway, a building topped by a large, gloomy water tower, and mountains of construction debris flanked by yellow cranes. The total effect would be dining al fresco in the post-apocalypse.
It may not look like much now, but remember, we're getting in on the ground floor,
Edward said.
There's talk the canal will undergo a massive cleanup, and rumors of nearby condo developments. By the time the neighborhood picks up, Clary's Pub will already be a local establishment.
If it survives that long. But Una banished the thought and tried to see the horizon through Edward's quixotic lens. He had a vision, and she had the means to help him bring it to life. As his partner, her job was to have faith in him. I think the New York restaurant world is in for something special, she said. Behind them, the patio door creaked open.
Oh, I didn't realize anyone else was here.
A petite woman with a fox-like face, olive skin and thick, wavy dark hair stepped out onto the patio. She had sophistication and poise, like she was sure the world was going to deliver exactly what she demanded. Her features made her lineage tough to guess. Could have been South American, Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, Spanish, even Southeast Asian.
Francesca, what are you doing here?
Edward's frown deepened.
Oh, well, you know I never stop working.
Leaning against the doorframe, she peeled off her leather gloves with the suspense of a burlesque dancer. Her faint accent was also tough to trace. Italian? Israeli?
Since we're meeting with the interior designer on Monday, I thought I'd come in and do another sweep of the place, without the noise of all the contractors. What brings you around?
Same.
He turned to Una, putting a protective arm around her.
You'd think my consultant would take a day off, but she's as much of a workaholic as I am.
How well am I supposed to know this woman? Francesca gave Una a sardonic smile.
You'd think your husband would remember how much is involved in organizing a restaurant launch. The opening night party alone is a huge undertaking.
Oh, I'm sure, Una replied, sounding the furthest thing from it. If there's anything I can do to help. Waving a dismissive hand, Francesca replied.
It's under control, unless you've been hiding any celebrity friends who could attend the grand opening.
I thought you already had big celebrities lined up, Edward said.
Some, yes.
There was a note of defensiveness in her voice.
Not friends or Sex in the City big, but I have connections to David Blaine, Heidi Klum, and Kelly Osbourne. I may also be able to pull some strings to get Paris and Nikki, though so far I've only been able to get a direct line to one of their hanger-ons, Kim Carr something or other. One way or another, we will have a killer launch.
First, I need to make sure we can actually open on time, Edward grumbled. I'm still worried about the next MEP inspection. The mechanical should be fine, but electric and plumbing might have issues.
We'll get there, don't worry so much. Listen, why don't I give you two some space? I can come back another time.
Francesca turned to go. After she left, as Edward locked up, Una asked,
Does she know about
my condition?
No. Why should she? That's a personal matter, and she's just a business associate.
A very pretty one. Should I be worried? Edward rubbed his bare hands together and blew into them.
Bad day to forget gloves. There's a diner on Smith Street if you want to get breakfast, have a chat, get used to each other some more.
Una's head was full of so much new information. Adding in a getting-to-know-you meal with her new husband was too much. Actually, do you mind if we go home? I'm not really hungry, and I could use some time to settle in. And I'd like to call my mother.
Madeline is on vacation.
A sharp look of disbelief. What?
She took a cruise with Nathan, her boyfriend. She's coming back in 2 weeks.
Oh. Disappointment coursed through Una like mercury, weighing her down. She just left me to fend for myself with a strange man? Again? Is that what she does now? Noticing Una's soured mood, Edward asked,
What can I do to cheer you up? Take you to a movie? Buy you flowers? Do a funny dance?
He did an impromptu jig on the sidewalk until she cracked a smile.
Or would you rather have a bit of time to yourself?
Once again, his innate understanding released a pressure valve within her. Yes, that. And maybe a movie later? The brownstone was usually her sanctuary, but going home felt odd now that her house held a new resident. She'd have to get used to the physical reality of a husband. The shared space, decreased privacy, another person beside her in bed every night. She couldn't let Edward sleep in the guest bedroom indefinitely. Less than a day into the marriage, and an unspoken expectation hung over her, for her to get back to normal or find a new normal. Back home, Edward busied himself in the kitchen, and Una went to her study, locking the door behind her. She checked the safe for the binder. It was intact, its pages filled with her numbers and notations. At the top of the 2004 section, she'd written, Edward doesn't know about this binder. No need to tell him. That made sense. Though maybe she'd encourage him to buy Google stock when it went public in August. It would make for a nice buffer against any potential money lost in the restaurant. What about money you might lose in the divorce? Una put the binder away and headed to her desk file cabinet. An apprehensive knot formed in her lower back until she found the prenuptial agreement. She waded through the legalese until its terms were clear. In the event of a divorce, neither party was responsible for spousal maintenance, and each would retain their separate income and assets. The house, bank account, and investment portfolio were still solely in Una's name. A holding company in her and Edward's name jointly owned Clary's Pub and the Gowanus property housing it. So her main assets were secure, and she wouldn't have to pay Edward alimony when, if, they split. Next, she reviewed the Clary's Pub paperwork. There were construction contracts, insurance documents, copies of licenses, permits, and invoices. Most of the bills contained 4 or 5-figure numbers, but a few were into low 6 figures. Customized buildouts, tableware, kitchen, and bar equipment. A rough calculation tallied the costs to date at over $1 million. That is one expensive dream. Judging from some of the bank records she reviewed, she funded more than that. There were big purchases at stores like Brooks Brothers, Ralph Lauren, and Salvatore Ferragamo, presumably attire for Edward. Additionally, she'd been writing him a $5,000 check every few weeks. I give him an allowance? And paying his credit card bills, which also amounted to thousands per month. whatever she spent on Edward or the restaurant, wouldn't affect her overall financial health. But if she supported him to such an extent, was the nature of their relationship transactional? Put more simply, am I buying his love? It was a rational notion considering her circumstances, but in this case, the numbers couldn't tell the full story. If the marriage to Edward was going to work, she'd need to have more faith in her earlier self. Una put away the paperwork and headed downstairs to the music room. Once she put on a Velvet Underground record, she regarded her wall of guitars. Growing up, she'd opted for rock music over pop. Where other girls were singing Olivia Newton-John songs into hairbrushes, Una would grab a broom, crank up Brian Eno's Here Come the Warm Jets, and strum her makeshift guitar. She'd never envisioned herself as a rock goddess, but got a rush at the thought of performing music. When she began seeing Dale and he enlisted her to be in his band, they'd gone to a store on King's Highway to select an instrument for her. The curved, gleaming bodies of the guitars immediately lured her, like mythological sirens. As if reading her mind, Dale picked up a red and white Stratocaster and said, "I've had my eye on this one. Been saving up for months to buy it." After working summers as a cashier at Genovese, Una also had enough money saved for a guitar, but Dale discouraged that idea.
"I don't see Early Dawning as a two guitars kind of band."
He tapped a finger against his chin, musing.
"We could use a different instrument to flesh out our sound."
Granted, they didn't have a sound yet because they were still forming the band, but Una didn't point that out. Instead, she glanced around the store, tamping down her desire to hold one of the acoustic guitars, run a hand along its polished wood, strum its strings, and whisper her secrets into it. Dale put a hand on the small of her back to steer her away, his resolute palm saying, "This is my dream, not your dream." And she shuffled along, too indifferent to think of any new dreams, trying to block out the herky-jerky opening notes of Hotel California being plucked out behind her. Until Dale came to an abrupt stop.
"Hey, how about this?"
He swept his hand across a silver Yamaha keyboard like a game show model. Before she could reply, he took her by the shoulders and coaxed her behind the instrument.
"This is exactly what our band needs. You could be on keys and backup vocals."
I never thought of myself as a keyboardist. One last longing look at the guitars as Dale continued to plead with her.
"Early Dawning needs you, Una. Please be our keyboardist."
It was easy to look into his intense brown eyes and agree to anything. So she bought the Yamaha, took lessons, and got pretty good. She grew to love being in the band, which Dale described as edgy rock with a post-punk soul. But playing the keyboard was a marriage of convenience, and she never grew to love her instrument. "I do love these beauties, though." She reached out to one of the guitars when there was a knock on the door.
"Una, are you there?"
Edward called out. "I'm here." She opened the door.
"Is everything all right? I thought you might have gotten hungry, so I made you some lunch."
He held up a tray with a domed lid covering a large plate. "Everything's fine." Her expression of pleasant gratitude was a mask, tight at the edges. "I just got lost in thought. Come in."
"I made panko fried chicken and truffle mac and cheese with soppressata."
He set the tray down on an end table and lifted the lid to let the rich food smells fill the room. With all Una was processing, there should have been no room for hunger, but her mouth watered as her appetite betrayed her. "This looks great."
"It really doesn't."
A smirk at the beige, yellow, and brown meal.
"I have a tendency to make food that tastes good, but looks like a dog's dinner."
"I'm sure it's delicious. Thank you." Edward nodded at the record player as the tinkling notes of Sunday Morning began.
"This is my favorite song."
"It's sweeter sounding and catchier than their usual stuff, but I love it too."
"What's funny is that it's essentially a song about paranoia, warning you to watch out because the world is behind you." but I've always found it strangely comforting.
Her smile, now genuine, broadened. Me too. It was a diaphanous bridge, yet firm enough for Edward to step forward, push past her invisible boundaries and embrace her. The hug was not perfunctory or patronizing, but tight with sympathy. A hug that superseded platitudes like, "I'm here for you and everything will be okay," while still conveying those things. As if her body remembered what the rest of her had forgotten, her arms lifted up and tightened around him. She fit her head into the crook of his neck, which smelled of freshly baked bread and campfires. That's when her body betrayed her for the second time. Her muscles coiled with a desire for sustenance, a larger appetite surfacing as she pressed closer to her husband. Sensing the shift, Edward moved his mouth to the curve of her ear, breathed warm air against it. He ran a slow hand up her back, looking for red lights in her body language. Her small size told him, "Go, go, go." She lifted her head until the sides of their faces were pressed together, her smooth cheek against his soft stubble. All the numbers trickled out of her brain like a window open to clear out a smoky room. There was only the geometry of her mouth and his, inches apart, then centimeters, then. Their kiss was soft, tentative, filled with question marks. "Is this okay?" asked both sides. "Yes," was the answer. "Yes, on both sides." Una clutched Edward's sweater, responded to his kiss by opening her mouth. The tips of their tongues touched, asking more questions. But the resounding answer was always affirmative. The lights all green. Go, go, go. Not since the stranger at the club had she felt such a dizzying attraction. Was it natural chemistry? Or a deeper need to satisfy her loneliness? Whatever the reason she wanted him, she was coming off a year of parties and drugs and trysts, some of which had been fun, but all of which had been meaningless. Sex had been lost in a haze of chemicals that heightened or anesthetized or disassociated. She hadn't had sober sex, or sex signifying a deeper connection, since Dale. Edward helped her out of her sweater, and all worries of the year ahead faded. She needed his skin against hers. He drew her into another deep kiss, pulled her down until they were kneeling on the shag carpet. Her knees creaked, a backward echo of future aching. Up above, mouth to mouth, their tongues did the exploring. Down below, their hands took over. They shed layers of clothing with the same unspoken courtesy of their initial kiss, their hands like gentlemen with top hats asking, "Pardon, do you mind if I remove this brassiere for you? May I cast aside these boxer briefs?" And always the answer was yes. Always the answer was go. Kneeling above her, Edward offered a questioning smile. Even though her body was responsive, her skin experiencing déjà vu, eager for him. Before he entered her, he asked,
"Is this okay?"
She nodded and he began slowly. But she craved a bit of pain, always did. Found it gave a counterbalance to her body's pleasure receptors, the way spicy food hurts but can be so delicious. So she thrust her hips to be filled completely in one abrupt motion.
"I didn't know if you'd still want it a little rough."
A low, throaty chuckle. "I do." She was less pliant than she'd been in 1991, but equally receptive. It helped that Edward knew when to slow down and when to tantalize her tender spots. A light scratching along her ribcage, biting beneath her collarbone, licking right behind her earlobe. He worked as if from a blueprint, privy to her hidden corners. As she got close, he kept withdrawing to build it up, tease. When she finally did come, it was unbearably intense, a prelude to multiple orgasms. His own climax followed. Edward rolled off her. They lay on their backs, several inches apart, breathing hard. The carpet felt like fur against Una's naked skin.
"Wow. So that's what married sex is like," That's what it's like for us.
His index finger sought hers out, their digits linked together. But were they monogamous? Once again, the name Peter invaded her thoughts.
Do we have any
special arrangements in our marriage I should know about? She remained still. Could he read her murky thoughts, decipher the pounding of her blood like Morse code?
Special arrangements. As in, do we have an open marriage? God, no. Why would you wonder that?
I mean, she scrambled for a reason. We have this age difference.
5 years, that's nothing. And I've always fancied women a bit older than me.
He turned on his side and propped himself up on an elbow.
I appreciate being with a woman who's truly lived, truly experienced. I find all that a turn on.
It confirmed what 2003 Una said in her letter. But it also tugged at her like a fishing hook she'd swallowed and couldn't retrieve. Because she was a facade. Her face and body might hold history and character. But being 21 internally made her far from seasoned. Surely it wouldn't be long before Edward sussed that out and realized he was married to an imposter. Chapter 15. In the days that followed, Una didn't see much of Edward, who rose early and came home late, drained of energy, filling her in on the latest catastrophes at the restaurant before passing out in the guest bedroom. A bathroom pipe burst, an electric socket that had to be raised 2 feet threw off the MEP inspection. There were delays getting a liquor license. A crate of pint glasses was delivered in shards. Something was always going wrong. One day, Una set an alarm to get up before him. I thought we could have breakfast together, she said as he entered the kitchen, a newspaper under his arm. I made a pot of coffee. How do you take yours?
Oh.
A grimace flashed across his face.
I actually drink tea, sorry.
It's fine, that's good for me to know. One cup of tea coming right up. But before she could reach for the kettle, Edward said,
No, no. I'm a picky bugger about the way I like it. Steeped exactly 5 minutes, one level teaspoon of sugar, tiny splash of milk. It'll be easier if I make it myself.
Okay. She stepped over to the fridge. I was going to scramble some eggs, unless you're a picky bugger about the way you like your eggs, too. Keep it light. This isn't easy for him either.
If I'm to be honest, I am.
There was a sound of rushing water as he filled the kettle, a click as he lit the stove.
But I usually start the day with kippers on toast. I can make you eggs.
You don't have to make anything special for me. I can have kippers on toast, too. Whatever kippers are. Her hand hovered over the refrigerator handle. Edward gave a hearty laugh.
They're smoked herring, and you ate them.
Ah. Much as she wanted to be in on the joke, Una could muster only a feeble smile.
You usually skip breakfast anyway.
Scratching the stubble on his jaw, he searched her face.
Una, what's this about? Are you hell-bent on making me breakfast because you think that's what a good wife is supposed to do for a husband?
Embarrassed tears stung her eyes, and she turned away, occupied herself with taking the milk out of the fridge. I don't know. Maybe.
I'd hate to think what Madeline would say about you embracing such traditional gender roles,
he teased. She'd probably curse the patriarchy, then make me burn my bras. Edward took the milk from her, set it down and put his hands on her shoulders.
Even if I wasn't a chef, I wouldn't expect you to cook for me. That's not how it works between us.
How does it work, then? Such a big question. It quashed her voice to a whisper.
By understanding each other. Knowing when to step in or step back. Being patient, which you've been fantastic at.
I've been patient? That doesn't sound like me.
It's the you I know. I work long hours and don't always get to see you as much as I'd like.
Guilt twisted his eyebrows.
But we try to find quality time together.
Una thought back to her letter's advice. What if I was more involved in the restaurant? What do you have going on today?
Today?
A frantic expression crossed his face as he reviewed the outstanding tasks.
I need to meet with a beverage vendor and a local butcher, review the latest interior designs, test a new recipe, and finish writing the employee handbook.
He took a deep breath.
Last year, you did help with a bit of the accounting and inventory, but you found it dull, and I don't want to subject you to that. Really, it's fine. This business isn't for everyone. You're much happier focusing on music and your philanthropic work anyway. And with your memory condition and the opening 6 weeks away, I'd hate for you to get mixed up in all this madness and clog your head with rubbish.
It was like swimming upstream with no clear destination. The letter told Una to make an effort, but her efforts seemed to hinder more than help. So she stepped aside and let Edward take care of his own breakfast and his own restaurant. He did try to include Una more in subsequent days, asking her opinion on paint swatches, wall decor, menu items. Though it felt perfunctory, a polite gesture. If only she shared Edward's passion for food as an enterprise. Alas, she didn't want to know how the sausage was made or what kind of plates it would be served on. So mostly, she kept out of restaurant matters while continuing to fund it. To keep busy, Una tinkered on her teal, egg-shaped iMac, pleased to have the internet again, though she still refrained from looking up any friends. The first time she'd done so, learning their fate left her more disconnected, lonelier. Lesson learned. Besides, she wouldn't use technology as a crutch or excuse to remain cooped up. After the scrunchies and pagers of the 1990s and the leggings and smartphones of the 2010s, she was curious what details, large and small, would stand out to her from the 2000s. So she ventured into the city, where Manhattan's skyline was like a beautiful smile with a missing tooth, the Twin Towers gone, the Freedom Tower yet to be built. She walked everywhere, taking mental snapshots of today's society. Apart from the baffling proliferation of fedoras and trucker hats, fashion struck her as either too comfortable, with velour tracksuits as acceptable day wear, or too uncomfortable, with pointy heels squeezing the life out of female toes everywhere. Except when it was both, in the case of lowrider jeans. Refusing to get swept up in clothing trends, Una aimed her shopping dollars at record stores, many of which wouldn't be around in a matter of years. Cell phones were ubiquitous but more primitive, with social media and other apps still years away, so people were less absorbed by their digital devices, which would make seeing The Killers, Kanye West, Thievery Corporation, and others in concert later that year far more enjoyable. When home, she spent a lot of time in her music room. In 1991, she'd ignored her records. Her personal soundtrack had been peripheral, party girl dance beats for nightclubs and wild gatherings, which left her ears ringing. But now she had a clear head to enjoy music again. Friends and relationships might slip away year to year, but she did have some continuity, a strong lineup of people whose songs would always be in her life. Lou Reed, David Bowie, Brian Ferry, Kate Bush, Mick Jagger, Prince, Debbie Harry, Iggy Pop. And others would reappear in surprising ways. A week into the new year, she received a postcard from Thailand. One side, a photo of limestone cliffs dotted with shrubbery like a patchy beard, forming a circular lagoon around water the color of Midori and blue curacao, swirled together, like a cocktail awaiting a straw and paper umbrella. The back of the card read,
"If you're ever in hell, go somewhere that looks like heaven. Sad today, but a little less sad than I was yesterday. Lonely, but this is what I need right now. Kenzie."
An initial gasp of delight was swept away with a frown as Una reread the message. The cryptic note contained no address besides hers, and no clues beyond the Thai postmark. What did it mean? Why was Kenzie sad and lonely? And why did he need to be thousands of miles away? Hopefully, they'd cross paths again soon. In the meantime, she still had Madeline, who called when she returned from her cruise in mid-January.
"I want to repaint some of the rooms in my apartment.
Will you come help me? No warm greeting. No niceties. Una had expected a more conciliatory tone. Unable to keep the sulk out of her voice, she said, "That's the first thing you ask? Not, oh, I don't know, how is married to a stranger life treating you? I imagined we'd cover that while we paint." "Goody. We can also cover why you're never around when I need you most. Why don't you just hire a professional? Because doing the work yourself can be more satisfying. When I look around at my newly painted walls, the result of my labor, or our labor, depending, I'll enjoy my home that much more. If I hire painters, I might take these walls for granted." "Will your boyfriend be there?" "Nathan and I broke up." "In the middle of your vacation?" "I'd rather not discuss that. Now, if you can't help me..." "No, I will. Just tell me when and where." "Are you still in Bensonhurst?" "Bay Ridge. I'll text you the address. Wear clothes you don't care about." "You got it." "Hey, I got a postcard from Kenzie. Do you remember him?" A pause. "I don't know who that is." "Really? You never met him?" "I never mentioned him?" "Una, I have no idea who you're talking about, and I'm sorry, but I really need to get started here." Was the recent breakup causing her mother to sound tightly wound? Or was there something more? She'd have to find out in person. An hour later, Una arrived at her mother's penthouse apartment. It had a sunken living room, a wide balcony with a view of the Verrazano Bridge, and seemingly endless white walls. There was something stiff in the way Madeline hugged her. Reluctant. Her face held no clues. Botox treatments had left it smooth and inscrutable. "I thought we could start in the bedroom." Her mother led the way, the word "juicy" bedazzled across the rear end of her pink tracksuit. "When we were in St. Kitts, I discovered this charming antique store decorated in the most divine colors. It brought the whole space to life and inspired me to add more vibrant color to this place." In the bedroom, the furniture had been pushed to the center of the room and draped in drop cloths. Madeline held up two paint swatches. "First, we'll do a base coat in teal. Once that's dry, we'll add a sponge effect with the magenta." Taking a lap of the huge room, Una said, "Mom, your ceilings are like 12 feet high. This could take days." "Maybe you have something more important you need to do?" A sharpness to her breezy lilt. "I wouldn't be here if there was." Why isn't she being nicer? They were two people crossing an iced-over lake. Every treacherous step brought forth another crack, another fissure, until inevitably someone would fall through to the frigid waters below. Madeline opened a paint can, stirred its contents with a wooden spoon, and tilted a sea of teal into a roller pan. "You weren't kidding when you said vibrant," Una said. "That's a lot brighter than it looks on the color sample. You sure it's not too much?" It was a ludicrous question. Madeline favored the bold, bright, exotic. Her apartment was decorated with a menagerie of trinkets and artifacts from India, Tibet, Africa, Japan. Her wardrobe was equally colorful, full of blinding saris, woven belts, kimonos. For a time, she'd even tried to pull off turbans. When she was a child, Una didn't mind Madeline picking her up from school, wearing outlandish ensembles. Until the kids snickered and nicknamed her mother United Nations. No amount of tearful pleading would get her to swap the global get-ups for simpler dresses. "Too much?" Madeline echoed, handing her daughter a roller. The ice was getting thinner. The mature thing would have been for Una to be direct, to tell her mother she felt neglected. But it was easier to add spikes to the tender emotions and find an alternate release for them. "I know you like bright colors, but this combo is hideous. You'll be looking at these walls every day, and it's gonna be, let me guess, too much." The words dripped with sarcasm. "I happen to know my taste quite well and chose these colors thoughtfully. I think they're beautiful. But since you find them so hideous, don't feel obliged to help me." a grunt of incredulity. Her knuckles went white, gripping the roller.
Mom, what the fuck? You keep making it sound like I don't want to be here, but you're the one acting like you don't want me here. Is this about your breakup? Because you've never let men get to you before.
That's right. I'm the composed one. You're the one who falls apart whenever things don't work out with a man in your life. Crack. The ice gave way and they both fell through. Una dropped her roller.
How would you even know? You're always trying to weasel into my personal life and be my best friend. But when I actually need you, you're on fucking vacation. And now, instead of being remotely sympathetic about my situation, having a brand new husband I don't know and barely see, you're giving me shitty attitude.
Fists on hips, Madeline huffed.
I didn't realize I needed to be at my grown-up daughter's beck and call. I thought she'd be able to act like a capable adult without my input. But it turns out I'm a neglectful mother with a shitty attitude who's not allowed to have her own life. Thank you so much for reminding me.
Why are you being such a bitch? The words hurt to say. She'd never called her mother names before. As if expecting the insult, Madeline's eyes lit up.
I'm the bitch? You have no idea. The things you said to me. You're the bitch.
Una recoiled at the nasty boomerang.
What did I even say to you?
Just now.
I was only...
The lines in her forehead smoothed with realization. Or do you mean before? No answer, but the sharp set of her jaw was affirmation enough. Mom, what's going on? Madeline loaded her roller with paint and moved toward the nearest wall, but stopped shy of it. Her shoulders sagged.
We had a fight. It was awful. We've never fought like that before. Not about anything. I booked the extended cruise to make sure we'd be away through Christmas and New Year's, figuring you might not remember it when I got back.
Did you leave yourself a letter?
I did. But it only said the year would start off shaky for us. No mention of any argument.
I just got back from 1991. How casually put, as if announcing she'd returned from the grocery store. I'm 21. I haven't lived in this decade at all. What did we fight about? Madeline's surgically paralyzed brow could betray no distress, but her eyes still conveyed bewilderment. After all these years, I still can't get used to it. Sometimes you come to me as a child in an older body. I'd hardly call 21 a child. And other times you're this wizened soul, young on the outside, but even older on the inside than I am.
Mom, you're dripping paint on the floor.
I can't imagine how trying it is for you. But it wears on me, too. I don't know how to be a mother to you sometimes. You were rarely a willful teenager, so to see you behaving like one in the body of a grown woman.
She shook her head.
I don't know what to make of it.
I know.
Her voice caught in her throat. I know there are certain things I'm supposed to forgive because of your circumstances. But sometimes...
You don't want to?
Una took the paint roller from her mother's hand and placed it in the pan.
I want to. But sometimes I feel like I can't.
Madeline sat on the edge of the bed, the plastic tarp rustling beneath her. She covered her eyes, inhaled through her nose. Unlike her daughter, she didn't cry easily. Unsure, Una remained standing, a stranger in her mother's home.
Tell me what we fought about.
I can't.
Why not?
Maybe if you tell me, I'll be able to prevent it from happening in 2003.
Your future is my past.
I can barely get my head around it. A mirthless, machine-gun chuckle.
No, my dear. Your life shouldn't be about trying to prevent mistakes. Make mistakes. But learn from them and live with them.
A black, hissing voice in her head. How many mistakes can you live with? A mist of regret crept into her, She took in small gulps of air, released tears and more tears.
Come sit beside me.
More rustling as Una joined her.
What is it? Why are you crying?
I wonder.
Staccato words through jagged bursts of air.
I wonder if...
A hard swallow to quell the sobbing.
I wonder if I ever get things right.
Do any of us? We all do our best. And even with your time travel, you still live through each year only once. You don't get any redos.
But what if I could do better? What if avoiding last year's fight makes this year better?
Madeline took a moment before answering.
There's no telling whether it would change much. Maybe that fight needed to happen.
A downcast turn of her mouth, but Una nodded.
Another thing to consider. Even if you could prevent it and ended up changing your future, you wouldn't know how, because you already lived through that year. And if you start going on about alternate timelines again, it'll give me a headache, so please, let's not go down that road. Make your life more about letting in the good things than preventing the bad things. You're not going to stop any wars or stave off any big tragedies. You're not Sarah Connor, and the Terminator is now governor of California.
You
do good by being a good person, making others happy. Embrace that.
Do I make Edward happy?
You do.
How? And does he make me happy?
Yes, I think so.
Madeline took the tone of a witness on the stand, measuring out her answers. Recalling 2003 Una's warning, she pressed on.
Are you sure?
Trepidation trailed like ivy up her spine. Madeline looked at her daughter, unblinking.
I think you make each other happy. The rest of it is none of my business.
They were back on solid footing, but still skirting the ice. Better not to risk another fracture. Una walked over to the pan of paint, picked up the roller, and began zigzagging swaths of teal across the nearest wall.
How is everything with Edward?
Her mother asked. Now that Una had an opening to voice her marriage concerns, she was more reluctant to do so.
I mean, it's weird, having someone around the house. It's not like it was with
Kenzie.
Perhaps because they'd had more time to develop a friendship. Una was lucky if she saw Edward an hour or two a day with his hectic schedule. I mean, it's not like it was when I lived on my own and didn't have this other person I'm legally tied to. But I'm getting the hang of it.
Was she?
At first, I was worried it was gonna be a repeat of the Crosby situation, where I felt like I had to pretend to be someone else. But I don't have to pretend with Edward. A lie. But sometimes pretending was better than being alone.
It's such a relief.
It wasn't. But at least the sex was good.
Careful, Una, the paint is dripping. You're laying it on a little thick.
Una gave her mother a look.
Really?
The paint, I swear I'm only talking about the paint. Use less on the roller so it coats evenly.
She got up and demonstrated on a second roller.
You mentioned you don't get to see much of Edward.
Oh, that's only because he's so busy getting Clary's pub ready for the grand opening. I'm sure things will calm down once it's up and running. Of course, Una was sure of no such thing. But she wanted to believe it, and to see Edward's dream come to fruition. But it had been easier when she and Dale had their band and shared a common dream. Everything had been easier with Dale. They worked in silence for the next few minutes, the only sound the sticky slap of paint rolled onto the walls, as if the color was resisting its new home. Una spoke first.
Is it terrible that I still wonder if anyone will ever measure up to Dale?
It's not terrible. But it's not realistic. Or healthy. Dale was your first love, which is beautiful. but I think you sometimes put him on a pedestal. He was a real person. He had flaws. I know he had flaws. Did she, though? What do you think his flaws were? His table manners, for one thing. He'd talk with his mouth full. His elbows were always on the table. It drove me crazy. Una rolled her eyes. How could you let me be with a monster like that? But she'd never noticed these breaches of etiquette. And judging from her mother's hesitant look, there was more. How much did she want to know? What else? She finally prodded. Keeping focused on the wall, she said. He was a talented musician, and certainly had drive and good looks. But he could be a little full of himself. And bossy. I worried about that sometimes. He had a power over you, like you couldn't make your own decisions without him. What? Una nearly dropped the roller. What are you talking about? You preferred to wear your hair short, but grew it out because Dale liked it long. I was trying something new. Isn't that what being a teenager is about? Noncommittal murmurs from her mother. Are you saying he was controlling? Una asked. Not controlling, but a strong influence. Give me another example. You never wanted to be a keyboardist. That was undeniable. Yeah. The word came out between a whisper and sigh. I thought I'd be happy playing anything as long as I was making music. And I was. I loved our band. You wouldn't have been happier playing guitar. I didn't let it bother me. I figured Dale called dibs. It was his instrument, so be it. She attacked the wall with her paint roller, a new vigor filling her. Ever since Dale died, these last two leaps at least, I thought it would be betraying his memory to take it up. Like I was saying, oh good, now that you're dead, I can do this thing I've always wanted to do. But if he held you back from something you were so passionate about, maybe he was the one betraying you. Madeline's words were feather light, but detonated within Una, sending her reeling forward. Palm to wall, she caught herself as the epiphany ricocheted through her. While she'd held their love story as epic in her heart, part of her had been pretending with Dale, too. She might be decades late, but at least there was one charade she could resolve. When she finished helping her mother, on her way home, she picked up a copy of The Village Voice. Una flipped through the back pages, checking the ads until one caught her eye. Guitar lessons. All skill levels. Reasonable rates. Ask for Peter. Chapter 16. How do I know this is the right Peter? The question orbited Una's thoughts as she made her way down 7th Avenue and crossed Flatbush into Prospect Heights. Since the start of her leap, she'd wondered about this second name the woman on the subway had mentioned. Maybe 2003 Una hadn't wanted to spoil the surprise of taking up the guitar, but changed her mind at the last minute in order to reunite her with her music teacher. Except, this Peter hadn't recognized her name over the phone when she set up the appointment. Would he recognize her in person? Either way, the ad in the Village Voice had to be a sign. Her hands were slick with sweat, and the guitar case nearly slipped out of her hand as she approached a beige row house. A few steps down to the garden level, and she faced his apartment door.
Are you Una?
A male voice called out behind her. She turned as an Asian man in black jeans and a leather jacket approached. He appeared to be in his mid-20s, and his hair, which was overdue for a cut, flopped across his forehead.
Sorry I'm late. Subways were a mess. Hope you haven't been waiting long. I'm Peter.
Though he showed no recognition as they shook hands, she was immediately drawn to him. Yes, he was attractive. His frame long and lean, his mouth full and faintly smiling, his eyes kind. And yes, there was the leather jacket. Just like Dale's. Just like mine. But it was more than that. When she stepped into his living room,
The first image that greeted her was a giant poster of a yellow banana on a white background. Andy Warhol's Velvet Underground album cover. And when Peter took off his jacket and rolled up the sleeves of his sweater, along his forearm was a tattoo, a vertical row of glyphs Una couldn't decipher.
"It's Korean,"
he said, noting her curious stare.
"It means everything has its time."
The hair on her arms stood on end, and she knew. An unresolved puzzle in her life had been decrypted. This had to be the right Peter. That first lesson, when he put his elegant, tapered fingers over hers to demonstrate correct positioning, something within her began to glow. And when she played a series of chords that added up to an actual song, Tom Petty's Free Fallin', her veins surged with a brand new high. Inspiration and creative satisfaction were tinder, igniting dormant desire. From then on, her days took on a new brightness and ease.
"Your strumming patterns are getting better."
"I bet you say that to all the girls." Una didn't mean to flirt with Peter, but it came naturally to her, just as learning the guitar did. Not that it was easy. At first, she struggled to pluck out a single note correctly, then a scale, then open chords. In the first few weeks, more than 15 minutes of playing left her hands aching. Sometimes she played through the pain. Other times she had to set the guitar aside. But the better she got, the more she wanted to play, and the more she looked forward to her twice-weekly lessons. By early February, her passion for the instrument verged on obsessive.
"You must be practicing a lot,"
he said halfway through their lesson. "Hours every day. I keep picks around everywhere and leave the guitar out, like you suggested."
"I wish my other students had your level of dedication."
"But then I wouldn't be your favorite student."
"That's true. How are the hands feeling?"
"Okay, but my wrist is a little sore."
"You're bending it too much."
He massaged it with his thumbs, pressing into the upper bulb of her hourglass tattoo. It wouldn't be fair to Edward. A persistent, pragmatic mantra. After the debacle with Crosby, a determination to keep libidinous impulses in check. She told herself it was displaced affection, like a patient falling for her life-saving doctor. The guitar was her compass and light. The routine of practicing, the sense of purpose,